It went straight down the middle. Then it started.
Welcome to another edition of For the Good of the Game and Bruce Devlin. With today's guest, I got some good news and some bad news.
Well, let's hear the good news first, please.
Well, the good news is this 87th guest of ours is the youngest guest we've ever had on the program, which means that his recall is probably going to be better than some of the folks we've had.
I would say a lot better than some folks we've had on, for sure. And the bad news?
Well, the bad news is I hear that even his son can beat him on the golf course.
Well, I think we've all gone through that at one time or another. But I got to say one thing. This gentleman that we've got with us today was born in probably one of my top two favorite towns in the entire world. And that is Cape Town, South Africa. He's played on five different tours. Has been successful on all of them. And I suppose his greatest claim to fame is the 2008 Masters champion. And Trevor Immelman, thank you, sir, for joining us today. We've looked forward to this for quite a while.
Hey, guys. It's great to join you two and talk a little golf and reminisce a little bit. Mike's correct about all of that stuff, you know? You get to the point where your son or your daughter is better than you. They start beating you at sports. It's a tough pill to swallow when you've been a professional athlete for a few decades. But hey, you know, it's fun to pass that torch along as well. But it sure is great to join you all today.
Well, great to have you. And it's a proud day for you and the family because we know that your son, Jacob, has just committed to play golf in college at Clemson University. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks so much. Comnita and I are extremely happy for him, proud of him. He's been a huge fan of Clemson for the longest time. First went to a football game when he was 4 or 5 years old, and really has been his dream throughout his schooling time to end up going there one day. So now for him to get to that point to where it's going to become a reality is very special for all of us, and good to see him and experience him taking this next step. It's a lot of fun for us. It's going to be an adjustment. Just be three of us left back here at home in Orlando with our 13-year-old daughter, Maya. But we'll be cheering him on for sure.
Yeah, well, if Maya wasn't spoiled already, she's about to get spoiled probably, I guess, right?
That's right.
Well, great to have you. As you know, probably having listened to a few of these, that we always go back to the beginning. In your case, you don't have to go back that far. We've had guests that had to go back into the 30s to remember their childhoods, pre-World War II. And, of course, you get some fascinating stories from those days. But you go back to your beginnings, 1979, born, as Bruce mentioned, Cape Town, South Africa. Let's hear a little bit about what life was growing up back in those days for you.
Well, born, like you say, December 79, youngest of three children. Grew up in a very loving family, middle-class family, in a town called Somerset West, which is kind of cradled between Stellenbosch, which is wine country, and the Strand, which is right on the ocean front. Just a magnificent part of the world. And, you know, it was fortunate being the youngest. My older brother and sister kind of took the brunt of all the disciplining from my parents, you know, when we were growing up, and I was the kid that just kind of rode on their coattails and had a blast, and you know, they shielded me from any kind of trouble. And you know, South Africa is such an outdoorsy, outgoing, sports loving nation that, you know, any child that grows up, you play in all sorts of sports as you start to go to school and you're hanging out with your friends. It really is fantastic upbringing. And when my brother went to high school, enrolled in high school, he decided to take up golf. And so I was 5 years old at the time and, you know, just tagged along with him and his buddies and went down to the local golf course, Somerset West Country Club. And that was it. From that first interaction, that first experience, just completely and utterly fell in love with the game. And really from that moment on, every time my eyes were open, I was either playing golf or thinking about golf.
Yeah, that's great.
Thinking about golf, trying to get, out to the States, to the PGA Tour. Like, it absolutely consumed my upbringing, was the sport, and was fortunate to grow up, like I said, in an area where public golf courses were plentiful, easy to get on. It was quite cheap to play still back then. And the golf course that we were members at had a lot of juniors, a lot of great amateur players. And so there were a lot of people for me to be able to watch and mimic and compete against and learn from. And so really it was just tremendous, tremendous upbringing when I look back at it now. Very fortunate.
I hope you appreciate your older siblings being the trailblazers that they were.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. They definitely, had it a little tougher for me and were able to give me some good advice of the do's and don'ts as I was coming through.
Stay away from all the trouble.
Exactly. Like I said, my brother's 9 years older, my sister's 6 years older than me. And so, in a sense, it was like having two bodyguards that were kind of looking out for me all the time. It was great.
I played the trailblazer role in my family, first of four, and I know how easy my youngest brother had it after three siblings went before him. He got away with murder.
Exactly.
So you tagged along with your brother. That was sort of your first exposure to the game then?
Yeah, exactly right. He had a bunch of friends at school that took up golf at the same time. And like I said, this golf course, Somerset West Country Club, had a number of top amateur players. One of the guys competed in Junior World. A couple of the others played for the South African national team. So, like, we're talking about legitimately good amateurs. And so it was such a blessing for me to be able to grow up in that same system and watch them and learn from them and be in the club's league team with them. From about the age of 12 or 13, I'd made the club team and was going off to compete with them against other clubs in the area. And so really, my weekdays consisted of packing my mother's car early in the morning before school. My dad would drop me at school on his way to work, and my mom would pick me up in her lunch break. She'd pick me up from school, drive me straight to the golf course. I'd, get changed there, practice for 4 hours or so. And then my dad would pick me up on his way home from work. And that happened 5 days a week. And then the weekend came and I competed in league matches or junior tournaments or amateur tournaments, or even if it was just club competitions, the Saturday club competition. I was so fortunate with the membership at the local club. Particularly in those days, you could run into some clubs where there were some pretty stringent rules for juniors being able to compete on weekends or in the club competitions and stuff like that. But, all of the membership were so nice to me looking back at it now. They saw my work ethic. They saw how much I loved the game. They appreciated how good I was for such a young age. And so they welcomed me into all of the different competitions, and a lot of times I would caddy as well on the weekends for the members. And so I was just at the club 7 days a week, and it was a tremendous way to grow up with like I said, all these top amateurs and juniors and the caddies and the caddy program. Just a really great time.
You think about all the pathways and forks in the road that you're faced with throughout life, and I'm just thinking back to the story you relate where, let's say that some of those very good golfers were not there for you to see and compete with, or let's say that you were at a place that wasn't quite as welcoming to juniors. Just woulda, shoulda, coulda. Maybe you would have gone down a different path.
Yeah, Mike. Yeah, look, you've hit the nail on the head, and I think as we spend some time together here over the next however long we chat for, hour or two, you know, those threads will start to become more and more apparent. You know, I think back to 1987, so I'm a seven-year-old kid, and there's this big national amateur tournament that comes to the club, to Somerset West Country Club, and there's this young blonde-haired phenom by the name of Ernie Els that competes in this tournament. And so let's just think he's 18 years old, 17 or 18. I'm 7 or 8. And he was already famous in South Africa for how good he was. And so, you know, I just made it my mission to follow him around for the whole week. And I was never more than 5 steps from Ernie Els for the whole week while he was playing the tournament.
You knew who to follow, man.
Exactly. So stuff like that, yeah. At such a young age, for me to be able to watch that caliber of player and learn from them, and, you know, not just learn from their games, but learn how they behave themselves, how they handle adversity, how they treat other people. So many different areas where somehow, some way, I just seem to be in the right place at the right time. To be able to really, I mean, I hate to use the word fast track, but yeah. You kind of know what I mean. Just to help me along my way and feed the fire, and continue allowing me to be hungry and work hard. Really, really fortunate.
So those fires you talk about, they were burning a long time before Ernie Els. Of course, we had the great Bobby Locke.
That's right.
Whom I had the great opportunity to play with in your country 20 years before you were born. So, and, you know, South Africa's got a great history of being sports people, great cricketers, football players, you know. I mean, it's a, like you said, it's an outdoor society. Television, when you were growing up, you didn't even know what it was about, probably. You saw a little bit, maybe, not much, though.
Yeah. Look, Bruce, just kudos to you. It was people like you from your generation who came to South Africa, and it'd probably be remiss for us, you know, not to mention the difficult political climate and situation that our country has had been through and has been through for the majority of its existence. And many people, athletes like you, at times at the behest of Gary Player, who was trying to really do the right thing you know, put South Africa on the map in the correct way and for the right reasons, you know, we're trying to use sport as a pathway to make some change and to force some change. And so, you know, thankful to people like you that that were able to come and do that and give us some great athletes to aspire to be like. So, yeah, you know, we are an outdoors nation. I've always thought, believed that South Africans have a special type of hand-eye coordination. Like you say, if you look through all the different sports over the years, just tremendous talent that has been able to come through that country. You know, the fire that we talk of, you know, a lot of our smaller nations, we have to have that because we've got to fight our way to the top. We've got to fight our way to try and be recognized amongst the greats like the US. You know, there's always that little chip on our shoulder when we come from smaller nations.
You know, pound for pound on a per capita basis, your nation has done quite well in athletics over the centuries, or over the decades, anyway, right?
Yeah, we're very proud of that. In particular, you know, just recently, the Springboks won the World Cup for the fourth time, which is just remarkable. You know, when you consider that they've now won 4, which is the most ever, and they weren't even allowed to compete in the first two because of being sanctioned. Yeah, when the country was going through all that turmoil. And so, very, very proud of our athletes, whether it be swimming, soccer, rugby, cricket, golf, you name it. It's always fun to see the South Africans break through because, you know, it's been, you know, there's a lot of adversity that comes with that. People that have fought really hard don't always have the funding necessary to compete with the best, mm-hmm. but they find it within themselves to still break through. So it's special when it does happen. It really is special.
Yeah. Let me pick up on a couple of things that you've mentioned before. One just being the difficult political climate and the period of apartheid that South Africa went to. Of course, we talked to several fellows. One that came into your life early on was Gary Player from South Africa. And we've also talked to some of the guys that he used to bring down, like Bruce or like David Graham. I remember him talking about bringing Lee Elder down, which was quite groundbreaking at the time, right? And all the difficulties that people faced because they're trying to do the right thing by the country and by the game, and yet they were chastised for a number of the things they did back then. So it's been interesting to just through some of our episodes, learning the history of your country and learning the travails that many of the players went through to try to take the game to another level down there.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, every country has been through different amounts of it, some way, shape, or form. But yeah, like you say, like we touched on earlier, athletes like Gary that really tried their best to open things up, to spread the right message. He actually told a story recently when I was doing a golf day with him in Philadelphia about that time, like you mentioned, when Lee Elder came down there and how he had to actually get special permission from the government mm-hmm. in order for that to happen.
Yeah.
And when you...
I was on that trip.
It feels, Bruce, it feels so weird to even say that in the day and age.
Surreal, yeah.
It's completely nuts. And thankfully, that way of thinking is gone. But, and thankfully, Gary stuck to his guns and found a way to get things going. And, you know, when he tells me stories of that trip, and Bruce, you'll be able to share even more. But what a wonderful trip it was and how people fell in love with Lee Elder because he's such a wonderful man to begin with. And now they were able to see what an incredible athlete he was and golfer he was on top of that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, those are really going back 5 minutes or so ago to that original thread of how fortunate I've been for the right things to be happening at the right time. And at times without me even knowing it, mm-hmm. to then be in a position in the mid-90s when our country finally becomes a democracy. And at this point, I'm a teenager. And now I have the opportunity to be able to come over to the US and to Europe and compete against the best and hone my skill and really start to find out if I'm good enough or not to compete with the best. You know, all of those little things play a part. And if it weren't for trailblazing athletes, who knows how things could have turned out.
Yeah, so you met Gary at a fairly young age. I think you were about 5 years old when you first met Gary Player. Bruce, you were much older when you met Gary Player.
I was a lot older. I was. You'll get a kick out of this. I played an exhibition with Gary when I was 17 years old. In a little town called Yass, Y-A-S-S, 9-hole golf course with sand greens.
Wow.
And that was, you ready, 69 years ago.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
Yeah, so I've known him for a long, long time. He's one of my great friends that I've had through this wonderful game of golf. It's just... I was talking to a friend the other day and we talked about, you know, count all your friends, you know, how many friends have you met through playing golf? And you'd be shocked at the number of people that say that, well, they are most of my friends.
Yeah, that's so true. That is a wonderful story. And I was fortunate enough to be with Gary just a couple of weeks ago. And he just celebrated his 88th birthday. Which is a lot of fun. And one of his granddaughters just got married as well. So he's got a lot of cool things going on. And he's down in South Africa right now. They just had the Nedbank Challenge at Sun City. So he was there for that. And, he's been a massive, massive part of my life in many ways. Mike, you mentioned the first time that I met him, just 5 or 6 years old. He came and did an exhibition at our home club. And I was just mesmerized by him, you know, the charisma, the energy. He was, let's just think. So we're talking mid-80s here. So he's slightly past his prime. He won his last Masters in 78, but he still had that aura, you know, when you can just feel it from people that really have it.
It's like the energy bunny.
Yes. And when, you know, people that walk in and they all of us, they change the whole dynamic of a room. That's how Gary is and always has been. And I was mesmerized by him. And I remember he had this new fairway wood. It was a 5-wood, an old Cobra 5-wood that had these rails at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And he was standing on the ball and then hitting these 5-woods with the purest flight out of a plugged lie because of these rails at the bottom of the club. And he was talking about, you know, at that point, how amazing that technology was. And I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. And really that was, once again, you know, one of those things that just gave me fuel and made me want to work even harder. And then you fast forward, 7 or 8 years, and lo and behold, then he's designing a golf course in my hometown. Now I'm a teenager and really starting to show some promise and winning a lot of junior tournaments in South Africa. So he invites me to come play with him at the opening of this golf course called Erinvale Golf Estate. And from that moment on, I really played well that day. He was asking me to hit different shots. I could hit all the shots he wanted me to hit. Mm-hmm. And I'm chipping and putting well. And that is something that always excites him. And from that moment on, he took me under his wing. And really, we had constant contact from that moment. And even to this day, like I said, you know, we do golf days together and charity days. We just did one for he and Vivian's foundation in Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago. He's just a wonderful man. He's been like a father figure to me. Very thankful to have him such a big part of my life.
And, you know, at age 88, as you know, he's still chasing backswing length. He's still chasing speed, isn't he?
100%. I mean, he's fascinated by the game. He still loves the game. He plays almost every day still. Yeah. If he can't go and play holes, he hits balls. He's always working on his swing. He's trying to find new things. Whenever we're on the range together, he calls me over. He's like, Trevor, just watch this. Am I doing this? Am I doing that? This is what I feel like it does for my swing. And he gets so excited. I tell people all the time, I've never met, and you know, this wonderful game has allowed me to go to so many different countries and golf courses and meet so many awesome people. But I've never ever met in any walk of life anybody with as much constant enthusiasm as Gary Player. He really is special, and it's quite fascinating because he, you know, when you talk to him about that and you really dive in trying to learn where this all comes from, he puts it all down to the amount of adversity he faced as a child. And you know, his mother dying young and his father working in the mines and coming home from school, taking the bus and the train home from school and nobody being at home and just having to fight and really appreciate everything that he does have. It's amazing. Amazing story.
Yeah.
How many people he's affected in a positive fashion all over. That's it right. Really is a testament to him.
May I give you a backup to that, to the enthusiasm?
Yeah.
I went to Pine Valley a couple of weeks ago to play a couple of rounds of golf with my son and grandson. And When I got there, I found out that Mr. Player had played that morning when I and had left the the property. So when I got back to my house, I called him, and I won't use the word that we use to one another, but I left him. I didn't get him on the phone. I left him a message, and then he calls me back, and he says, "I said, well, why didn't you wait for me? You know, we could have played around together." I said, "Oh, Bruce," he said, "Bruce, you got to listen to me, man." He said, "That last day I played at Pine Valley, I felt like I won the U.S. Open." He said, "I shot that. I shot 72 around Pine Valley."
Yeah, he loved it.
So that just backs up what you're talking about. He's always, he's winning the US Open again when he's 88 years old.
Yeah, he loves it. He enjoys every day. It's a treat to be able to be around him.
Well, we certainly had a pleasure having him on the program. I'll mention one name, Trevor, that you probably know something about this guy, but most South Africans and a lot of Australians would probably credit this man with the development of a portion of your game, because Gary Player and Bruce Devlin learned bunker play from this fellow, and that was Norman Van Nijde.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's an interesting thing how South Africans and Australians always get credited with such great bunker play. I'm convinced that for the Aussies, the ability to learn how to hit sand shots out of bunkers that you find in the sand belt area, and the way, and even, it's not just there. I've played a lot of golf in Perth as well. And the type of sand and the way they prepare these bunkers, really does lend itself to learning great technique and becoming a magician out of the sand. Aussies are so good at it. And then, Gary as well, having learned from Norman and all those guys, it's one of those talents that sort of gets handed down through the ranks. As you see youngsters come through, you get in the sand with them and start
teach them how to do it.
Little things, yeah.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Well, Norman tried to embarrass young Bruce one time at a little exhibition, as I recall, Bruce. Wasn't he in the sand demonstrating a shot
Yes. You'll get a kick out of this, Trevor. When I turned pro, I was with Slazengers in Australia.
Okay.
And they sent me on a 2-week trip playing 9-hole exhibitions and teaching and doing some teaching to different clubs around the country, around Australia, up the coast in New South Wales and back down through the Tablelands. Mm-hmm. So we get to a little town called Taree, and if you probably didn't get to spend as much time around Norman, maybe you didn't at all, but he was a little bit like Gary. He could tell a story we finished our 9 holes, and he takes a shag bag of golf balls and he puts it in the bunker on the left-hand side of the green, and he's telling everybody how, because he is a magician out of the bunker, and he's talking about that, and he's saying, do this and you do that and this and that, and what should happen is this, and then it should go down there close to the hole. And while he's talking, he takes his swing and the ball comes out just the way he said, and it hits on the green, runs down, goes in the hole. And then he walked out of the bunker and said, now Bruce will show you how to do it. which was an exact copy of what he had just done. We both holed the first bunker shot we hit, and that was end of the clinic in the sand. No one was game to hit another shot.
Exactly. You see what I mean?
Yeah, funny, isn't it?
Born with a special talent with bunker play. It's fascinating. And you look at the players through the years. And as a South African, we'll adopt Tony Johnson for a second.
Yeah.
He was born in Zimbabwe, but another player who, when I was a kid, I watched, he was unbelievable. In fact, on the European tour, his nickname was the Desert Rat because he was so good out of the sand.
Yeah.
And he was such a scrappy player. And Ernie and Retief were both great out of the sand. And you go to the Aussies and you look at Ogilvy and you look at Brett Rumford and the players that came before Elk, there's just a particular way that this group of players were
got passed along
to land that leading edge and that soul through the sand. It's get that sound that is just a little different to the rest.
Yeah. I'll give you a little Masters trivia that if you don't know it, who knows, maybe you'd find a use for it someday on the telecast. But Bruce, when he turned pro, 1961, he gets an invitation to the Masters. And Bruce, you can kind of finish the story.
Well, I turned it down.
Really?
I didn't have
Clifford
any
Roberts.
Money to come over.
Clifford Roberts.
So I then turned, I had just turned pro in 61 after I'd won the Open in Australia, but I had no money, so I turned it down. And then in Australia in those days, you had to play for 12 months without getting any prize money, but you had to prove that you could play. I don't know if you ever knew that or not.
It's wow,
such a ridiculous thing.
That.
Yeah. So I won two golf tournaments and never got any money for them. My first year as a pro, and I got another invitation to go back to the Masters in 1962, and I even had to write a letter to the Australian PGA to get permission to play in Augusta, because the Augusta tournament was 3.5 weeks before my 12 months was up.
Wow.
So sort of really a little ridiculous. And then, you know, I got to Augusta and guess who I played my first practice round with?
Let's hear it. Is it Gary?
Ben Hogan.
No way, really?
Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
So we never know what's in store for us, Trevor.
How was that experience? You got to give me a little more.
Oh, I was petrified. Yeah, and Norman Von Neider, of course, was very close with Mr. Hogan.
Okay.
And he was with me that year. We walked into the locker room at Augusta and he said to Mr. Hogan, would you consider playing a round of golf with my young friend here from Australia? And he said, yeah, sure. So he always had one trait with me for all the years we played together, and when we walk on the first tee, he'd pull my driver out and he'd put it in his hands like this, you know, and he'd go, that feels like a buggy whip. He said, you should be playing, because he used to use Apex 5 shafts in his driver that were tipped. They were
didn't
like
want a hook.
They were like telephone poles.
That's right.
Anyhow, we're here to talk about you.
No, but I got a couple more questions on that first. The so often in life, I've found that you looking forward to something, you build it up, your expectations and your imagination just run wild. And then a lot of times when the experience actually happens, it wasn't quite as great as your expectation. How was it? How was his game? Was it as impressive as all these books and stories
absolutely.
You read of?
Yeah, he was a wizard. Really?
Really?
I think he's, and we talk about all the great players that we've had, and certainly we've had a lot. Nicklaus, for one, for instance, has been, credited with this. Trevino, I think Trevino is the closest ball striker of consistency to Hogan. I thought Hogan had more control of the elevation of his golf shots. You could sit and watch him hit six irons or drivers. And I swear, if you put a little box up there at the apex of the club of the shot, they were all going through that little box.
Is that so?
Now you know what it's like trying to hit a six iron to hit ten of them in a row that look the same.
Sure.
Not easy.
Sure.
No. So he was. I think he was the greatest ball controller that I have ever played with. And of course, I played with Trevino a lot too, and Jack. But yeah, interesting. I don't know if everybody else would agree with that, but that's my opinion.
Yeah, that's what Gary says. Gary also says Hogan and then Trevino.
Oh, does he? Isn't that funny?
Yeah, he does. And interestingly enough, I've asked Tiger Woods who was the best ball striker he's ever seen live, mm-hmm. and he says Trevino as well.
Isn't that funny? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. Well, and Trevor, you and I both know it. It's not whether you hit it hard or whether you hit it or cut it or not. It's the control of the elevation that,
sure,
that gives you consistent distance.
That's right.
So those that can put it through that little box at the apex are the ones, yeah, that impressed me the most.
Yeah, 100%, particularly in those days when you consider the quality of the golf balls and stuff
slightly
like that.
Slightly different, huh?
And even the turf, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, the type of turf you're hitting off and the length of the grass and stuff like that.
Yeah.
To be able to have that kind of control back in, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, completely different to the players of this day.
Of today, yeah, no doubt about it.
Yeah, when you're playing a golf ball that you need to put through a steel ring on two
That's
different
right.
axes to make sure that it's playable.
Yeah.
That was part of our dress in those days. If you didn't have the 2.68 steel rim in your pocket, you were going to have some trouble because you hit a driving an 8-iron and that golf ball may not be any good anymore.
That's right.
So a postscript on the Hogan thing then. So from that momentous practice round of Bruce's first exposure to Augusta National with Mr. Hogan, from then on until Hogan retired in the late 60s, anytime he and Bruce found themselves playing in the same event, they generally played their practice rounds together.
Yeah, which Fantastic. Was great.
Yeah, Fantastic.
My best week of all was each time we went to Augusta, because that's where we first met, and we played Jack and Arnold and Trevino, and, you know, we played all the guys usually just one match during the week, maybe on the Tuesday, you know, because
sure.
you got the par three on the Wednesday and stuff. So we always had one little, shall I say, a slightly a gambling day with the other boys.
Great.
That was always fun.
Did that have any bearing, those friendships and that one in particular, have any bearing as to why you ended up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area?
No, I don't think so. But those years were I was in Florida during that
okay.
particular period of time, and then I didn't move to Texas until 1975. So that was 13 years after, and Ben had already finished because I think the last tournament he played was at Houston in 69, I think it was.
Okay.
Yeah. So those 8 years I had to play. Played a lot of practice rounds around. It was a lot of fun.
Man, that's cool. So cool.
Postscript on Gary Player then. Bruce, as a young guy, writes a book called Play Like the Devil. Who writes the foreword?
Gary Player.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that.
You haven't?
No.
Oh, dear.
Haven't seen that. I'm going to have to look for that.
It was on the New York bestseller list, the New York Times bestseller list, wasn't it, Bruce? He's going to find it on his shelf here somewhere. If not, I've got one. It's a yellow-covered book. There we go. Oh, you've got a different one there. I've got that one.
There you go.
That's second edition.
See that? Forward
that's first
by,
edition.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I don't
both
even think
are, I'm, both the same. Yeah, they're...
That's awesome. I'm going to look for those.
Yeah. So one other thing I wanted to come back to, and this gets back to your childhood and these threads you talk about. So it's interesting you mentioned Ernie Els as, you know, another sort of influence on you.
Yeah.
Many of our players, Bruce, and you can probably remember some of them, but they'll think back to, okay, for Kari Webb, it was seeing Greg Norman, right? Mm-hmm. For one of our ladies who played back in the 60s, it was Marilyn Smith. Right, that they hung up mm-hmm. with as a 5-6-year-old watching a tournament. For some, it was Patty Berg. You know, they mm-hmm. go back to these founders
Kathy
from the
Whitworth.
50s. Kathy, yeah. yeah, exactly. And how that one day in their presence, that's when they came home and told their mother, I'm going to be a professional golfer.
Yeah. You know, it's you never quite know when that inspiration is going to be found.
No.
Yeah. Some people it's seeing a little something on TV. For some people it's being at a particular sporting event or getting to see someone compete live. And like we touched on that, you know, those two moments, the one watching Gary hit balls at that exhibition and then the second one following Ernie Els.
Ernie, yeah.
during that tournament and watching him play. He actually didn't win the tournament. He lost in a playoff that week. And I was heartbroken that he lost. I was completely heartbroken.
My man didn't win.
Those are the things. Yeah. Those are the things that give you that fuel. People that you can try and emulate and be like.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway. It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.